The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
The story of the UK is an economy that has got real momentum.
What is broken can be repaired. What is ruined can be rebuilt.
UK inflation is becoming much more homegrown.
We have huge potential as an economy in the UK.
This is a time to tell Israel there is a path to peace.
Our plan for the British economy is working, but the work is not done.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Caroline Hepke.
And I'm James Walcock.
Now, have you been very miserable lately, James?
The weather is getting better. It's getting lighter every day, Caroline. I'm actually surprisingly upbeat.
Yes, look, I'm going to dash all of the cherry blossom optimism with this bit of news. No surprise if you actually are feeling miserable. The misery index shows that the Prime Minister is currently scoring lower than fellow Tory John Major was back in 1997 before his infamous defeat to Tony Blair. What is the misery index? Okay, a little bit of economics. I'm sorry, bear with me. It tots up unemployment and inflation, basically to work out the pain being felt very broadly in the economy. I mean, there are loads of caveats to that and how effective it is, but it's a big picture measure created by a very famous US economist called Arthur Oaken. And Bloomberg has run the UK data using the ONS figures, and it's created this misery index going back to the 70s, and it will certainly make miserable reading for the Prime Minister.
Well, it's picked some of the two economic indicators that are most visible to people, right? You know if you haven't got a job. I mean, it sounds almost too obvious saying that, but also you know when prices are going up in the old local shop. The question being, though, is that there are other factors. I mean, you look at tax, one that which is going to be quite key to stress in the sort of the coming weeks. I mean, he is going to be giving his big economic speech since the spring budget today. And I mean, papers say he's going to be saying there is now a real sense that the economy is turning a corner with all the economic indicators pointing in the right direction. This year, 2024, will be the year Britain bounces back. So there you go, Caroline. Your misery index is about to get a bounce back. Oh, God, I feel like I'm coming out of jargon. But all this economic jargon comes as some of the Westminster politics seems to be playing out in the background. The business secretary Kemi Badenoch has been forced to deny her own ambitions to become prime minister while speaking on broadcast channels this morning. I will say, Caroline, that if you ever hear a politician asked about their leadership ambitions, the very polite answer is always to deny. While you've got everyone sort of goes, well, of course, if you were offered the top job, you would take it.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, it does make you wonder what the prime minister and the chancellor can do to give the Conservatives a chance. I mean, they're facing kind of issues on many fronts, politically and economically. Over the weekend also, we had this major Bloomberg scoop about the possibility of something pretty radical, of a really big tax-cutting budget coming in September to try to avoid a wipeout, and then voters going to the polls basically October, November.
I feel like that famous meme of like, oh, another one, like another tax-cutting budget. How many tax-cutting budgets are we going to have before you've got enough, Caroline?
Well, you might need it if you read Irina Angell's piece on the Bloomberg Terminal this morning, Bloomberg's economics reporter, who joins us now to delve a bit deeper into the misery index. Irina, what sparked the idea to have a look at this? Because you've actually use this, the misery index, to look back all the way to Thatcher, to the 70s, and to pit each of the prime ministers against each other. Just how miserable did the UK feel during their, you know, during their tenure? Just tell us what sparked the idea for the misery index.
Well, that's right, Caroline. For me, what was interesting about the misery index is that, as you said, we can track it back to the 1970s. So it gives us a very, very big historical picture. But also the more interesting thing is that it sits right at the intersection of economics and politics. You know, this was an index that was created by an economist, as you mentioned, Arthur Oaken, very famous, was an advisor to U.S. President Lyndon B. Johnson. And, you know, it was created in the 70s to show how voters feel about the economy. And it helps explain, you know, this gap between how people feel about their own fortunes and real-time data, which is something that we see in the UK right now, because headline figures suggest the economy is getting better. There are reasons to be cheerful, but people are still feeling miserable. And I thought this index can help explain why is that happening and why do we feel like that.
Now, something that's really neat about your analysis, Irina, is that we all know that the economy has been a central issue for the Sunak government. You look at sort of the five pledges from last year. I'm not going to ask you to name them, don't worry. But halving inflation, reducing debt, growing the economy. But what you do is you chart that against election years for previous prime ministers. And also, what did you find?
So we find that incumbent parties tend to lose elections right after a surge in the misery index. So this might help explain why Sunak is keen to delay the next election, you know, in hopes that the economy will get better. People, maybe they will forget about the extreme levels of misery they've experienced, and that might increase the Conservatives' popularity with the electorate. So, yeah, exactly, like plotting the misery index against the times of the UK election kind of it helps explain the reasoning behind Sunak's plan to postpone the election. But many people actually challenge this view and say that it doesn't really matter when Sunak will call the election, because even if inflation comes down, people will still associate the cost of living crisis with Sunak and with the Tory brand.
Yeah, and I think that's the point, isn't it? One of the kind of unknowns about it is how far out do you have to get? How much of an improvement do you have to see for it to actually sink into voters? Because the truth is, you know, that the economic data might be as up to date as you like, but the person on the street, it may be months before they feel that again, you know, in terms of the cost of living and so on. It takes a long time for it to sink in. So how much delay do we need for things to look better for Sunak?
Well, you know, the OBR, the government's official forecaster, expects inflation to keep falling and like to fall below 2% in the next months. And of course, that will lead to a decline in interest rates. And they've also upgraded the growth forecast. But the problem is that, you know, you hear about falling inflation, but that doesn't mean that prices will go back to pre-COVID levels. It just means that prices will rise more slowly. And prices have already risen quite a lot and ate into the spending power of people. We're still, you know, living with the consequences of interest rates at their 16-year high, higher mortgage costs. And voters, ultimately, they care about levels. They don't care about year-on-year changes. And in level terms, they are a lot worse off versus a few years ago.
So on the scale of UK prime minister, you talked a bit about the economic indicators, Irina, but like who does Sunak compare to? You know, is he as bad as a Major era or a Thatcher era kind of defeat? Or is this just, you know, is this kind of Brown or Blair levels of sort of misery?
So Sunak is, he's better than Liz Truss. Sunak's average misery score since he became prime minister is around 12. And for Liz Truss, it was 15. And of course, that was only 1 month, so it wasn't really an average. But it's for Sunak is the most painful period since Major. So both Blair, Brown, Cameron, Johnson, they've seen lower levels than Sunak. So Sunak is very comparable to Major. It's lower than Thatcher era. So Thatcher was just about 15. Sunak is around 12.
Yeah, although I suppose, I mean, the whole issue with the Thatcher era is, you know, it was enormously painful at the time, but the whole point, I suppose, if you're a Thatcherite, is that it changed the economy for the better in the long run, although some people kind of suffered very significantly from it. Look, I thought it was also very interesting that when I was looking at the little charts that you've got in your piece about it, actually Blair and Brown, their misery index was really, really low compared to a lot of the Conservative leaders. So they were kind of presiding actually at quite a decent time economically. And so that kind of brings you to wonder about what a future Labour government, if there is one, under Keir Starmer might look like. Might not be so easy.
Yeah, that's right. That's what economists were telling me as well when I reported a piece, is that, while this might be good news for the Labour government in the short term, meaning that it will decrease the popularity of the Conservative government. If a Labour government comes into place, they will inherit a very difficult economy and they will inherit very high expectations, and people will judge them against those expectations. So if they're not able to bring down the misery index, they might face quite a bit of backlash.
Bloomberg's economics reporter, Irina Angell, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, from national misery to local difficulty, MPs have found that just 10% of the money that was set aside for levelling up the UK has actually been spent. This ahead of a deadline of 2026. The Public Accounts Committee said they uncovered astonishing delays. The findings also come as one in five UK council leaders say that they expect to file for bankruptcy in the next year. So Bloomberg has a long readout on this subject about levelling up. And James, you've been speaking to someone with hands-on experience of how all of this works.
Yes, I talked to former Liverpool City Mayor Joanne Anderson. She ran the City Council from 2021 to 2023, which is when the levelling up funding was mostly being bid for. I started off by asking her how levelling up has changed Liverpool.
It was a great slogan, but completely empty. The process of having to compete with the rest of the country, of the resources that go in from a local authority perspective to put a bid in, to be told, you're not successful that time. We've had a strategic futures panel in Liverpool that's been in operation for over a year now to come to the end of the process to secure levelling up bids that were ready to go 3 years ago. So I just think a whole load of extra resources for another 3 years have been wasted to, be successful this time when we've wasted a long time for that.
So for people that have been following it, there is a £10.5 billion pot of money that all should be spent by about 2026. And currently, they reckon only about £3.7 billion of it has been allocated. And of that, £1.24 billion spent. Well, the question for you, though, is what do you think it should have funded in the city?
So in terms of our city, we have our economy relies on the hospitality sector up to about 40-odd%, which was great. But as everyone learned during COVID, that's not sustainable. We're doing really good work around health and life sciences, and not just us in Liverpool, but across the whole of the north. So health and life sciences will attract jobs that will, have higher wages, will have a bigger impact on the city. So we're leveling up bids to support our strength in this area, to help grow our economy, would really make a difference, would have a massive impact on the city. I've just learned in the last couple of weeks that we've been successful. But I've got to admit, in the way the department run things, I have asked in the past, whenever we've received money, I kept asking, is it in the bank? Do we have it yet? Because actually the rules have never been clear, or they change the rules as they go. So actually being awarded it, to it actually coming into the bank account and being able to crack on the way, either is a very long process or a process that ends with you not receiving the money.
So in your mind, help me understand where this money is getting tied up.
Well, I don't work for central government, but being clear on the rules in the first place, the things I've read is that lots of people who apply for the money, lots of councils, they didn't meet the criteria, and then they've put all these resources to put bids in. Most of our government departments and local governments, we don't have the right complement of staff. We don't have the resources are really spread really thin. So to be submitting bids for work that you never got a chance of attaining is just a waste of our money and time.
Right. I mean, in turn, the Conservative National Government at the moment is saying that a lot of issues in local government are coming from council mismanagement. They'd point to Birmingham City Council. And I mean, they might even point to your predecessor, Joe Anderson, who stepped aside during a bribery probe. What would your response be to them?
So Birmingham, like Liverpool, have got the highest levels of deprivation. You know, in terms of the councils having problems, it's usually because we've got crisis in adult social care. You know, we've lost half a billion pounds over the last decade from government funds. And that's an average £100 per household. So, you know, it's all right pointing the finger saying, you know, problems in local governments. Look, as soon as, you know, they were out the way, those people who'd been involved in the alleged corruption scandals, we were ready to go as an organisation to fix our problems. We've had to spend a whole load of money on commissioners and everything else when actually all we needed was a good chief executive and a good finance director. So I won't speak on behalf of Birmingham, but it's got to be said, we do deal with the highest level of deprivation in both of those cities.
Well, and on that deprivation point, I think something else, we've got local elections coming up, and there will be at some point a general election. The Labour Party say if they were to win, the inheritance they face is very, very stark. Do you think they would need to match or even exceed the amount of funding that the Conservatives have penciled in, given the state of council finances?
Well, you've just got to look at Rishi Sunak messing with the formula of which councils receive money. So his affluent council could receive funding. And cities like ours that have got high levels of deprivation don't receive funding. So the Labour are going to do a better job, aren't they, of making it fair in terms of which councils receive the right amount of money based on the deprivation within those cities and areas. So, yeah, the government, the current government have got, you know, can't point the finger there. They've fiddled with the formulas in what local government
right
receives.
So for you, this isn't about councils having to raise more money or the government having to raise more money. It's about allocation. You see this as unfairly allocated.
Well, it has been when Rishi Sunak admitted to messing with the formula.
And how have Liverpool filled the gap then? What has been happening in the city without that money?
So I think we've recruited over 30 odd people in terms of our, you know, our leadership team within Liverpool City Council over the last couple of years. You know, we've dealt with the issues that we've had. We had an interim chief executive who really, you know, turned the organisation around from the moment that she stepped in. We've now got political stability in the new leader, Liam Robinson, will be in for a period of 4 years. You know, we've got a complement of staff to get the job done. So this is what we've been working on the last couple of years. Bids and, you know, all very welcome, obviously, levelling up bids and support, really welcome from our city so we can really make an impact in those deprived areas. We've worked on the council. The council is in a much better place. Now we need to just crack on with the business of fixing the, you know, the economic impact in the city.
It's interesting because you paint Liverpool City Council as, you know, very efficient machine. Obviously, the Conservatives would disagree for many reasons. But the other side of it is you look at the LGA, Local Government Association, they say that nearly one in five council leaders think they're likely to declare bankruptcy in the next year. Do you see Liverpool at any risk of that?
I can't comment on other councils, but no, we've never been at risk of that. And obviously, that was 3 years ago when the mayor was arrested. I worked hard for 2 years, turned it around, and the current leadership have working really hard. Wouldn't say it's an efficient machine that, you know, doesn't have any problems, but actually, we're not facing bankruptcy in Liverpool. They've just set the budget for the year, and we have turned the organisation around from what was how it was run previously.
Is it fair to say then, if you turn the machine around, everything's working fine, the Conservative government might say, well, why would you need more levelling up money at that point?
Well, say everything's working fine. We've got some of the highest deprivation in the whole of the country. If you look at how councils receive money, they receive money by putting their council tax up. 80% of our housing stock in Liverpool is council Band A. If we put our council tax up, that doesn't make a big impact here. It makes a big impact in the areas where the council tax band is council tax band H, where the, you know, the houses are worth millions and millions. And so the council tax contributes to their local economy. The other way is through business rates. And, you know, we haven't got a good track record in the region of business growth, and that's what we need the levelling up money for. Levelling up is a great term. It's a fantastic slogan. That's what our job should be as politicians. It should be making those who need the most help, you know, have the most support and, you know, tackle inequality. And so that's our whole job as politicians and local government. That's what the job is. In terms of how the governments have handled this, you know, the fact that it hasn't been spent and we have so many areas of deprivation and so many councils that are saying they're in need or in crisis, and and there's money sitting in the bank there that hasn't been spent. That's on the government. That's not on local government. That's on the national government.
I think, but where this takes me back to is that situation that you paint sets an even higher bar for the next government. And I'm sure Labour may be able to fix things with allocation, but does it not need a more radical intervention, maybe nationwide, but certainly from Liverpool's perspective? And that's going to have to involve either cutting services or raising taxes, right?
I'm not an MP. I'm not involved in national government. The Labour Party, if we win at the next election, are taking over a massive mess. And I've got to say, from someone who's been in that position, that it won't be fixed overnight. But with time, we'll have to, in the Labour Party, think of a better solution for local government rather than this merry-go-round of funding that we can't attain.
We're coming off a week where race, racism and money have sort of dominated politics. You're a black woman, Joanne. You've risen to the top of frontline local politics in a very short space of time, mayor of the city during Eurovision. And at the end of the term, you left. Do you still have faith in politics as a way of having positive change?
I never intended to stay longer than one term. My term was cut short because of the recommendations from the government, but I never intended to stay longer. I've always had political opportunity. I've never wanted to be a politician. You look at Diane Abbott, and I'm so inspired by how she handles herself, actually. You know, when I see a 70-year-old woman bopping up and down 46 times to try and speak on an issue that is about her, and being refused. Look, I don't know how she does it. So I'm absolutely inspired by Diane Abbott for being a black woman and putting up with that. But actually what she puts up with is absolutely disgusting.
Is there anything that would make you want to come back to politics? Is it about improving that environment?
I think politics has got a long way to go in terms of being cleaned up. I find it there's politics in every sector, in every organisation, but I find in politics that the behaviour of a lot of people is not in line with the values. So I'm a person who's values driven. I've got to work in accordance with that. I only feel rewarded by working in accordance with my values. I'm not very good at politics because I am a bit too straight. And so I've no ambition to be anywhere else in politics. Maybe if it cleans up its act a little bit and is a little bit more fair, then I'd want to be involved.
That was former Liverpool City Mayor Joanne Anderson speaking to me there.
Well, look, financial difficulties, the challenges of the job, but also the personal pressures. I thought that was very interesting from a former mayor. And of course, this when we're only a few weeks out, a couple of months out from the local elections and the mayoral elections on the 2nd of May.
I mean, it's interesting that Joanne was done after one term in the race for London mayor. The incumbent, Sadiq Khan, is running for an unprecedented third term. Here he is launching his campaign today.
So if you want a progressive as a mayor, delivering on free school meals, on freezing TfL fares, on investing in council housing, in investing in young people, in investing in police, let me your vote.
So that was Sadiq Khan then speaking and launching his mayoral campaign today. His main rival is the Conservative candidate Susan Hall, at least according to the polls. You do have, of course, nine other people running. The issue is Sadiq Khan, as you say, two terms in office now. He's got a lot of household recognition, I mean, across London, across the UK, right? These mayoral jobs have gained national significance. I think first and foremost, before you even get to the issues, it's about cut through and it's about whether, you know, Susan Hall has name recognition, and in fact, any of the others do. Who do you think are going to be significant runners and riders then in the race?
Well, London polling is very small, so it is hard to say. I mean, look, you've just got to look at it. Back in September last year, JL Partners ran a poll which put Susan Hall and Sadiq Khan within 3 points of each other on 32-35. YouGov then ran a poll a couple of months ago that put Sadiq Khan double Susan Hall's vote share on 50-25. So just on that basis alone, there is a lot of potential for upset here. The other really interesting... This is... Sorry, Caroline, forgive me. This is a very nerdy point to say. The London mayoral elections have moved from a second preference vote, where you get to say, I'd vote for the Greens, then my vote should go to Sadiq Khan, for example, to a first-past-the-post system.
So like the national system, and that's the change this time around.
Exactly. And that means that the Lib Dem candidates, Rob Blackie for Liberal Democrats, the Green Party candidate, Zoe Garbett, and the Reform UK candidate, Howard Cox, now have a lot more prominence, because if they take a vote away from Sadiq Khan or Susan Hall, who are, by most polling standards, the current front runners, that is a vote that isn't coming back. And so a lot of the current Labour Party analysis goes that actually this might be a lot closer election for Sadiq Khan than some of the polling might make out.
But I would argue London has changed a great deal. In fact, and population is at the heart of this, the rate of population growth in London is slowing. In fact, you had an outflow out of London during the pandemic, which has not happened since the 1980s. The population makeup of London is changing. There is cost of living, there is housing, transport, council tax issues. You know, it's going to be a really, really difficult vote, I think, for Londoners.
Well, now, on that population change, that's another interesting thing. So the New Statesman have some very interesting polling that they've gotten exclusively from Labour's private slides. Now, that changing London population, voter ID is a new compulsory thing for London mayor elections, as it will be for all elections going forward. And the Labour internal party strategists fear young voters, a lot of BAME voters, don't have voting ID. They think it could be, according to these slides, between about 15 to 20% of them. And that is, again, something that they worry can count against Khan. So you could swing this either way. And it genuinely is all to play for, in that you could argue Khan is the incumbent, he has the big media attention, it's third term, like, it's a national vote against the Conservatives, and Susan Hall is not a well-known candidate. Or you could argue the other way and go, these are big voting reform changes. On the third term, a lot of dislike, a lot of ULEZ issues. And this is where the sort of pacing of this gets fascinating. These local elections and mayoral elections coming on May 2nd are seen as going to be a slam dunk for Labour.
Yes.
Now, so any disruption to that narrative, if it were to be a Khan loss Hall win, that could break Labour's stride, cement Rishi Sunak's position, let him hold on for a lot longer.
Really? Do you think it's that serious? I mean, London skews, you know, vastly towards the Labour Party, you know, as a city. And you're right. I think the other argument that I would make is that Sadiq Khan, the pledge, his big pledge today was about 40,000 new homes, so doubling the previous target that he had. But as you've said, ULEZ is a pretty unpopular issue in terms of drivers in London.
Well, to give you the brief data, polling is inaccurate at the moment, especially for London. But looking at the previous election, 2021, Sadiq Khan beat Sean Bailey, the Conservative candidate, by 10.4 points after second preference. In the first round, first preference, he led by 4.7 points. So it's a lot tighter than you might think.
Yeah, look, I think it's a really fascinating topic. The full list of candidates, of course, you can find online. And we're going to cover it a great deal more in the next few weeks. I think it's, yes, you can argue it lots of different ways. The mayoral elections, the local elections, what are they going to mean in the national general election context?
That's it from us for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe and give it 5 stars so other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by Tiwa Adebayo, and our audio engineers were Marufa Hussain and Sean Guastamacchia. I'm Caroline Hepke.
And I'm James Walcock. We'll be back with more tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.